Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
It's Wednesday, the 30th of November. Good afternoon and welcome to Africa Link. I'm Eunice Onjiro in Bonn, Germany.
And I'm Oli Tangen Jr. with what's trending today on social media.
In today's program, at least 45 people are reported to have been killed in Aleppo in Syria in fightings between government troops and rebels fighting against President Bashar al-Assad. And a South Sudanese refugee criticizes the visit by UN Commission on Human Rights to the country.
How many times did they come here? And
how many times did the investigators come here and there was nothing at all, showing that they are coming here have some reflection?
And for social media today, we are going to Aleppo in Syria to bring you the story of a 7-year-old girl who has been live tweeting the carnage there.
But first, let's catch up with what's been happening around the globe.
I'm Mark Caldwell with the DW News. In Syria, rescue workers said more than 45 people had been killed in an artillery bombardment of rebel-held eastern Aleppo. The president of the Aleppo Local Council has urged the international community and the Syrian government to set up a safe corridor to help civilians leave the besieged city. The UN Security Council is to hold an emergency meeting on Syria later in the day. US President-elect Donald Trump has chosen Steve Mnuchin as his nominee for Treasury Secretary. The former Goldman Sachs partner and head of Trump's campaign finance operation has been giving reporters an inkling of his priorities for US business.
I know what it takes to make sure that we can make loans to small and mid-market companies. And that's going to be our big focus, making sure we scale back regulation so that we make sure the banks are lending.
South Africa has launched a major clinical trial of an experimental vaccine against the AIDS virus. The new study, known as HVTN-702, will involve more than 5,000 sexually active men and women between the ages of 18 and 35 in 15 areas around South Africa over 4 years. The trial has revived hopes of a breakthrough in the battle against HIV/AIDS. Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May has said her country hopes to tackle the issue of the future rights of European Union citizens in Britain and Britons living in the EU early on in talks on Brexit. She was speaking a day after a call from British lawmakers for a quick deal on mutual residence rights was rebuffed by the EU. Meanwhile, the Governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, has been commenting on Brexit risks to Eurozone and UK economies.
Banks located in the UK supply over half the debt and equity issuance by continental firms and account for over 3/4 of foreign exchange and derivatives activity in the EU. If these UK-based firms have to adjust their activities in a short time frame, there could be a greater risk of disruption to services provided to the European real economy, some of which could spill back to the UK.
This news comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany. In Zimbabwe, police have fired tear gas and water cannon to disperse scores of activists protesting in the capital Harare against the introduction of a new currency. The protesters fear that the new currency, called bond notes, will become worthless because of economic mismanagement by President Robert Mugabe's government. The leader of a coup blamed for destabilizing Mali 4 years ago is now standing trial on charges related to the killing of members of the presidential guard. Amadouhe Sonogo was arrested 3 years ago after a mass grave was found containing the remains of 21 elite troops. Sonogo seized power in March 2012, but later handed control over to a civilian transitional government. For more news and information, please visit our website, dw.com. I'm Mark Caldwell.
This is Africa Link. Amid major efforts to restore peace and stability in South Sudan, Thousands of citizens across the country continue to live a deplorable and miserable life as leaders fail to politically sort out their differences. The UN Commission on Human Rights have just wrapped up their 10-day visit to the country. Wake Simon Wudu reports from the capital, Juba.
Since December 2013, when South Sudan's conflict started, Bong Ku Bong has been living at the United Nations Protection of Civilian Camp in Juba. Ku Bong says he has no hope of coming out of the camp anytime soon despite the many challenges he, together with the other internally displaced persons, face inside the UN camp.
Somebody living in the camp always have a shortage of everything. The issue of water was very complicated last week. Then the issue of hospital. We don't have hospital in the POC, protection of civilians, these days. And we don't have enough food even.
Frustrations have been mounting as the peace agreement signed in August last year seemed to be falling apart. Yasmin Suka, head of the UN team of human rights experts who have been visiting South Sudan for the last 10 days to acquaint themselves with the situation, says rights abuses are on increase in the country.
Women in the camps recounted gruesome acts of sexual and gender-based violence to us, described how they were forcefully taken from their homes, dragged into bushes, tied to trees, and raped.
Soka also told the reporters that there is ongoing forceful recruitment of youth and child soldiers by both parties to the conflict, and indications, he says, suggest the warring parties are preparing for further conflict.
There are several steps that could and should be taken now to avert catastrophe. These are sanctions, asset freezes, an arms embargo, and the immediate deployment of the 4,000-strong protection force in South Sudan, which should not be restricted to the capital alone.
This is the second time the UN human rights experts visited South Sudan following the renewed conflict in July this year. Commenting on the visit by the UN officials, 43-year-old Ku Bong says such visits have so far failed to make an impact.
How many times did they come here?
How many times did the investigators come here and there was nothing at all, showing that they are coming here have some reflection? Like, for example, they have never even issued a statement that the propagators of these crimes being singled out.
Ku Bong wants the international community to revise the peace agreement and force the two warring parties, government and the opposition, get back to table and renegotiate the peace agreement.
Wake Simon Wudu reporting. Fighting in eastern Aleppo has killed at least 45 people, according to German news agency DPA. Syrian government troops have stepped up attacks in Aleppo in a bid to reclaim the rebel-held territory. Syria's five-year-old civil war has claimed more than 300,000 lives. Crispin Mokideo brings us more.
Tens of thousands of Aleppo residents are still caught in the crossfire between government troops and rebels fighting against President Bashar al-Assad. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which has been monitoring Syria's civil war, said an attack on Wednesday morning struck the Jub al-Kuba district. This is an area where residents displaced from the advances by government troops had sought protection. Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, warns that residents in Aleppo are trapped in the fighting with no way out.
It couldn't be worse. This is a 250,000 people in free fall. It's something that will become a stain on our conscience as humanity.
Bolstered by Russia's intervention in September 2015, Syrian troops have steadily recaptured ground once held by the opposition. Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova on Wednesday said that the Syrian army had significantly moved forward in freeing the city from militants.
14 residential districts of eastern Aleppo have been freed from illegal armed groups. More than 8,500 civilians, including about 4,000 children, used the militants' chaotic surrender to escape the districts controlled by armed groups that included Jabhat Fateh al-Sham, formerly known as the Nusra Front.
Russia has been accused by the US-led alliance of targeting the opposition instead of fighting the so-called Islamic State fighters in Syria. More than 300,000 people have lost their lives in the conflict, which has drawn opposing regional and world powers to the battlefield.
Crispin Mwakideu. Rwanda has opened a formal probe into 20 French officials suspected of playing a role in the country's 1994 genocide. President Paul Kagame's government has accused French officials, including senior military officers, of helping to mastermind and execute killings of some 800,000 people. I spoke to Phil Clark, lecturer in international politics at SOAS in London, and wanted to find out why Rwanda was opening this probe 22 years after the genocide and what this meant for the diplomatic relations.
The diplomatic relations between Rwanda and France have been extremely tense for many years. And this year in particular, those relations are particularly fraught because France has also threatened to reopen its own investigation into the shooting down of President Habyarimana's plane in Rwanda in 1994, which is something that France has historically pinned on the Rwandan Patriotic Front, the current ruling party in Rwanda. This latest investigation launched by the Rwandan authorities into French involvement in the genocide comes at a very, very difficult moment in relations between the two countries, and it's going to take a great deal of diplomatic work to mend these bridges.
Is this a tit-for-tat game between France and Rwanda?
There is a little bit of tit-for-tat going on here. It should be said that France's own investigation into the shooting down of the Rwandan president's plane is the fourth investigation into that issue. And the new evidence that has supposedly come to light in the French case, I believe, is extremely weak. It may look as though Rwanda is responding to the French investigation by launching its own criminal probe. But again, this is something that Rwanda has been preparing for many years.
We also see French officials insisting that any guilt for failing to prevent the genocide is shared by the entire international community. And they in turn accuse Kagame of only raising the issue to distract attention from what they say is his own poor human rights record. So is Kagame really trying to distract the attention from himself?
I don't think this is a distraction move by the Rwandan government. France has never taken full responsibility for the fact that it armed and trained many of the Hutu militias that carried out massacres in Rwanda in 1994. It provided intelligence and diplomatic support to Habyarimana's government in 1994. And also that France provided cover to genocide perpetrators who were fleeing Rwanda at the end of the genocide through a French peacekeeping force known as Operation Turquoise. So France is deeply involved in the perpetrating of the genocide. And really, without France, we probably would not have seen the genocide in Rwanda take the form that it did.
Phil Clark is a lecturer in international politics at SOAS at the University of London. Ole, fill us in with what's happening in social media.
Well, today we're going to head back to Aleppo in Syria to bring you the story of a 7-year-old girl who has been live tweeting the carnage in the city. Her name is Bana Alabed, and with the help of her mother, she's been using Twitter to document daily civilian life in the city. In one tweet, you see a smiling Bana, and with it she writes, "No one knows my life is difficult when I smile." She has also posted videos, and in this video, you hear the bombs as they fall on the city, and she is seen standing, looking out of the window.
Hello, world, do you hear that?
So, are her appeals being heard?
It seems her voice is being heard, as she now has 180,000 followers, including Hillary Clinton and Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling.
Do you have any updates on her safety?
Well, she actually tweeted just a few hours ago before we came to the studio, and she said she made it safely out of Aleppo, and we hope this young girl will continue to stay safe in Syria.
Well, we do hope that she stays safe indeed, and yeah, let's hope that everything goes well. You're listening to Africa Link, coming to you from our studios here in Bonn, Germany. Coming up here on Africa Link, Gambians go to the polls on Thursday, December 1st, amid a climate of fear.
We've interviewed certain people, and with some of them, there is the fear to speak out. There's also the fear to come up with who they would want to be associated with.
And we are going to be hearing about the plastic revolution happening now in Kenya.
But first, Somalia's presidential election, scheduled to take place today, did not happen as planned. The elections have been postponed for a third time now to an unspecified later date. The parliamentary voting is marred by irregularities and corruption, and Somalia's electoral body is investigating allegations of election malpractice. Among the presidential candidates is Fadumo Dayib, one of the first females to ever run for president in the East African country. So when are the presidential elections now going to be held? My colleague Tesfalem Erago put this question to Michael Keating, United Nations Special Representative for Somalia.
That is obviously not my decision. That is a decision that will be taken in light of the speed of the election of the MPs for the House of the People and the remaining MPs for the upper house. But things are picking up speed. So, you know, it is a guess when it will be. But my guess, and I want to emphasize, I'm not saying this is 100% certain, but my guess is that it will be around the 15th to the 20th of December, something in that time frame.
Will universal suffrage be attainable by 2020?
In terms of whether one person, one vote is possible in 2020, you know, it is a very ambitious target. There's no ID system, there's no voter registry. The National Independent Electoral Commission exists, but it has limited capacity. There are security considerations. This limited electoral process has been heavily protected, but it's one thing protecting an electoral process with 14,000 people. It's another thing protecting an electoral process with many, many millions. So I think it can be done. Somaliland has held universal elections, and Somalia is not that different to Somaliland. But a lot will depend upon the security situation. A lot will also depend upon whether institutional capacity is built between 2017 and 2020. And in some ways, a lot will depend upon whether the lessons learned from this 2016 experience are fully learned and applied. So I am cautiously optimistic that 2020, one person, one vote is possible, but I'm not saying it's going to be easy.
Is a 4.5 clan formula still feasible?
In my view, contrary to what many people think, that formula has brought a degree of stability to Somalia. But the next step is to try and build institutions which go beyond clan. You do not do that by undermining the clan system. You do it by building upon the clan system and trying to build, as I say, institutions that enjoy the trust and confidence of all Somalis. That will take time. A very significant point here is that when you sign up to become an MP in 2016, if you win, you have to commit yourself to joining a political party by 2018. And I think that's going to make a difference. And there's going to be rules regarding what a political party must have if it is to be legitimate. And it includes offices around the country, women's participation, and so on. And that may help move politics not completely away from clan, but into the area of political parties which have their own agenda.
Michael Keating, United Nations Special Representative for Somalia.
On the spot.
Gambians will head to the polls on Thursday, December the 1st, to elect a new president. Incumbent President Yahya Jammeh has been in power for 22 years and plans to stay on. Those who criticize him suffer harsh repression. DW's Adrian Krish filed this report presented by Fred Mvunyi.
Gambia's capital, Banjul, is bustling with life ahead of tomorrow's presidential election. From the outside, everything looks calm and normal. but don't let the business-as-usual mood fool you. A report by Human Rights Watch talks of a climate of fear in this tiny West African state. Since staging a successful coup 22 years ago, President Yahya Jammeh has used arbitrary arrests, torture, and kidnapping as a way to pressure journalists and civil society to impose self-censorship. Hannah Foster of African Center for Democracy and Human Rights Studies agreed with Human Rights Watch.
We've interviewed certain people, and with some of them, there is the fear that to speak out, there's also the fear to come up with who they would want to be associated with.
President Yahya Jammeh is often the subject of negative news in the international press. This was the case when he threatened to personally cut the throat of homosexuals, when he claimed that he could cure AIDS, and when he expelled critical diplomats, and when he announced that the Gambia was leaving the International Criminal Court. Yankuba Kori is Jammeh's long-time confidant and a key campaign organizer for the president. He says their candidate has unwavering support of the ruling APRC party.
The man has done extremely well. He has changed and torn the lives of the Gambians. That's the reason why people still love him. The 22 years is all of progress. The 22 years is all of awareness. The 22 years is all of development.
While Jammeh has won three presidential elections, the opposition was intimidated at every turn. This time is no different. The tension in the Gambia is palpable. After a political opponent died in prison, dozens of regime critics took the streets in April and May. Since the demonstrations were not registered beforehand, 30 protesters were sentenced to 3 years in prison. An opposition candidate, Adama Barrow, wants to stop this trend.
And we will bring in an environment that there will be no fear. We are in the 21st century. This thing cannot continue. And we have to follow the principle of democracy.
The state of the country's economy is one of the key issues of this election. Many young Gambians have taken the migrant route across the Sahara to Libya, where they bought boats bound for Italy. More than 10,000 Gambians fled this year.
A report by Adrian Krish.
Living Planet Africa.
In Kenya, a large part of society doesn't have access to power. Many people can't afford large solar systems either. But a German company is now selling small solar panels that can charge a mobile phone, a TV or a fridge. Since 2011, the company has sold 55,000 solar panels to people in Tanzania and Rwanda. Now they are expanding to the market to neighboring Kenya. They are expanding their market to neighboring Kenya. Bettina Rule has more from Nairobi.
Anyone who approaches John Kimani Wanjiru's property is always greeted by a gaggle of lively geese. Wanjiru lives in the countryside with his wife and three little daughters. Their house is about 40 kilometers away from Kenya's capital, Nairobi, and is not connected to the grid.
Welcome.
Despite having no access to the public grid, the TV is on in the living room. That's because since February, the family has a small solar panel on their corrugated iron roof.
I am so happy with it. It hasn't let us down once. My oldest daughter is using the light to do homework, and we are enjoying being able to watch TV now.
The solar panel was installed by the German company Mobisol. It has installed more than 50,000 solar systems across East Africa. The Berlin-based company officially launched their service in Kenya back in September 2015, and Wanjiru's family was their very first Kenyan customer. The solar system provides homes like Wanjiru's with enough electricity to power LED light bulbs, household appliances, and other devices like radios, mobile phones, laptops, and TVs. Wanjiru paid about 1,400 euros for his 120-watt strong solar panel, but also a TV, 5 light bulbs, and a rechargeable flashlight.
I think the system is great because it forced me to pay the entire sum at once. Plus, they came all the way here to install everything and didn't charge me for that. The public company would have asked for a lot of money before doing anything.
The family had to make a down payment of 80 euros. The rest they can pay off over the next 3 years. That's approximately 40 euros a month that they can either pay in daily, weekly, or monthly rates. And they can wire the money with their phones. Mobile payments have long become the norm in Kenya. Before they bought their solar panel, they also had to pay for someone to charge their phones every day. Now they can simply charge their phones from home without any additional costs. Their household battery has the storage potential to provide excess power to other people, says Andy Pond, who works for Mobizol's Kenyan office in Nairobi.
We monitor each system 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. We know exactly how the system's performing and how the battery's performing and what power the battery has and if there's a problem.
If there's a problem, then Mobizol sends a technician to fix it. And if a family has any leftover electricity, the company makes suggestions on how they can use the power in the future. The Wanjirus have big plans to use their solar power to generate more income.
We are thinking of using it, buying an incubator. You know, once you put the eggs there, they will hatch. Yeah, and it was an idea of still making income.
Gabriel Borod presented that report by Bettina Ruhl. So, Ole.
Staying in Kenya, we have to tell our listeners about one of our most popular videos that we have ever had on our Facebook page, DW Africa. It is from our Africa on the Move series and is called The Plastic Revolution. And it is about plastic in Nairobi.
So what's so special about plastic in Nairobi?
Well, it's not about what's special about plastic, but about what one entrepreneur is doing to collect the plastic waste and reuse it as a material to make building products. Her name is Lorna Ruto, and her company is called EcoPost. Her employees collect about 40 tons of plastic from the streets of Nairobi every month, which they then ground down and use as the main ingredient to make building materials, including posts for fencing. And unlike timber, it doesn't rot and it's termite resistant.
We make very good aesthetic and quality posts that can be used even for now building. An alternative to timber, so by so doing, we're able to save a lot of trees, and we hope to save the 2% forest cover that is remaining in Kenya.
And here is a farmer discussing why he chose to buy these posts instead of timber ones.
Compared to the normal posts, the lifespan of this one is longer than the normal posts, so I prefer this one.
The video has already had about 25,000 views.
Okay, Ole, now tell us, what are people saying about this project?
Well, it's getting a lot of praise. And Richard Obongo from Kenya commented to say, what a wonderful project. Keep it up to save our environment. And Nancy Diao Oloch wrote, simply awesome. Brilliant idea.
I bet the video is not just receiving words of praise, is it?
No, and then that's what's so different about this video. Most of the comments were actually from Kenyans wanting the contact to the company so that they themselves could buy these posts. And Saida Sabuni wrote, kindly give the price and where I can purchase these posts. I need to fence my place. And Jonathan Nyaga repeated that, saying, I need to fence my land in Mombasa. Kindly share their contacts. And David Arungumwai wrote, how can I get these fencing posts? So, I am in Nakuru Bahati.
Okay, did you then respond to these requests?
Yes, we did. We wrote, we posted the contacts to the company on our DW Africa Facebook page. And for any Kenyans out there who are interested in EcoPost, you can find them at ecopost.co.ke.
Well, a good idea for that company. And we wish the company great success. Remember, you can find more stories about Africa on our website. Just go to dw.com/Africa and do visit our Facebook page. That's DW Africa. From me, Eunice Wanjiru.
And from me, Ole Tangen Jr.
We wish you a wonderful day.